because we thought technology would prevail, but it never has. Not in Vietnam, not Reagan's perfect Star Wars, not in Afghanistan or Iraq. And yet that's what the tech folks are selling us. This new level of technology will put us in the driver's seat globally. China will capitulate because they're like, oh my God, you can make AI. We don't know what that is.
Hi, I'm Matthew Ho, a senior fellow with the Eisenhower Media Network. I am guest hosting Deep Focus this month. A new report by the Project on Government Oversight explains that the commonly cited U.S. military budget of roughly $1 trillion is an understatement. It excludes military-related costs across government agencies such as nuclear weapons programs run by the Department of Energy, veterans benefits, and military retirement and healthcare obligations in Treasury accounts, as well as military-related spending in the Departments of State and Homeland Security. Including those expenses in the U.S. military budget for fiscal year 2025 makes the actual Pentagon budget as much as $1.7 trillion. For reference, in 2001, that number was $340 billion, or about $616 billion in today's dollars. Again, the budget today is as much as $1.7 trillion. I got to keep saying that, right? That rise in Pentagon spending is 107% greater than inflation and 44% greater than U.S. GDP growth. It also outpaced our population growth. As a comparison, spending for non-military related expenses by the federal government kept pace with inflation and population growth and was behind GDP growth over the last quarter century. So to recap that, the Pentagon budget this century has grown almost 3.5 times faster than inflation, almost 2.5 times faster than real GDP growth, and almost 5.5 times faster than our population. Now, if you thought that was bad, if you include spending on interest and debt payments for past military spending and wars, which you should, that number then reaches as much as $2.3 trillion a year. These trillions go to a Pentagon that has never passed an audit and where $5,500 soap dispensers and $10,000 toilet seats barely raise eyebrows. And it's trillions to a Pentagon that has failed for decades in achieving the objectives given to it, this war in Iran just being the latest. Donald Trump wants to increase his budget by nearly $500 billion more this year, something his defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, calls financially responsible. For decades, political scientist William D. Hartung has monitored this ever-expanding military budget, the Pentagon's sprawling infrastructure, and its ever more costly purchases of weapons and systems that don't work. Bill has also been paying attention to and reporting on Silicon Valley's increased role in the military-industrial complex, the tech company's pursuit of a larger piece of this cash cow, as well as the Pentagon's adoption of new technologies for automated and robotic warfare, AI data platforms, and expanded surveillance systems. Today, we are going to discuss with Bill Hartung, Senior Research Fellow, Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and author with Ben Freeman of The Trillion-Dollar War Machine, How Runaway Military Spending Drives America into Foreign Wars and Bankrupts Us at Home. Bill is also a senior advisor with the Eisenhower Media Network, so we're colleagues. I also have to mention that Bill is a stand-up comic, and he regularly performs in New York and Washington, D.C. Bill Hartung, welcome to the show.
Yes, well, it's an honor. You're one of my inspirations. Not only are you a great guy, but you're on the right side of all the issues that we're fighting. So, and this is a wonderful podcast, which I really learned about from you. And I've been digging back into the archives. And I think, you know, whoever the final host is, they're not going to top what you did with that Muskism episode.
Well, I've only been doing a short time, Bill, but I got to tell you, you by far are my favorite guest so far. So just let's put it at that.
Well, my comedy teacher said you should quit with your head. So it was great seeing you, and I'll be back next week.
So, but I mean, you know, to the subject at hand here, right? And thank you for the very kind words. I appreciate that. And this is a fantastic podcast, and people who are new to it really should go back and look at, first of all, Professor Richard Wolf preceded me for a few episodes, but the work that John Kiriakou has done is just absolutely phenomenal, top rate. So people should go back and look at the previous episodes. But, you know, to the topic at hand, this $1 trillion war budget, really 1.7 trillion when you include all the other aspects of military spending, and over $2 trillion when you include debt and interest payments for past military spending and our past wars. Can you walk us through this, and why is this so, why do people not know about this bill?
Well, prior to that, you've talked about how America is an empire in decline. Well, these guys are accelerating that decline. The problem is, will we survive their decline because of their destroying things along the way? But, you know, now, basically, well, there's a guy named Winslow Wheeler, who, you know, he was a congressional staffer. He worked for the GAO. But he was on the side. He was critiquing the system quite deeply under the code name Spartacus. And he made the mistake of criticizing John McCain. McCain found out, he was canned, and he went into private, you know, nonprofit sector. But he is the first one I saw do this comprehensive analysis of what we spend on wars, preparations for wars, consequences of wars. So if you take the Pentagon budget, but also the VA, which has grown dramatically with the wars of this century, if you look at interest on the debt related to the military, some of the military aid programs are in the State Department. Nuclear warheads are in the Department of Energy. Homeland Security is basically the war against us at home to accompany the war against other countries abroad. So when you put that all together, you get those big numbers. But the $1.7 trillion, the $2.2 trillion is before the $500 billion more that Trump wants. And it's before they do whatever supplemental they're going to do to pay for this ridiculous, illegal, unjust, outrageous war against Iran, which Trump now wants to claim credit for ending, although he's not ending it. And of course, his good buddy Netanyahu is not going to stop fighting in Lebanon. And whatever deal they come up with is going to be worse than the one that already existed that he destroyed. I mean, you know, I don't know how you, what do you compare this to? I mean, 1984 is not even an appropriate metaphor. I mean, the lies come by the minute. And people either buy them, or they shake their head and say, yeah, it's true, but what can I do about it? And so I think we need not just the kind of information we have here, but the kind of organizing that you have done in the political sphere and the cultural sphere. And people need to understand that it's up to us. You know, it's if we want to have a world that's run in the interest of humanity, not robots and tech bros, then we better get cracking. And a lot of people are, but I think we can do more, and people have to come to understand that they have power, even in this kind of mismatched, competition that we're in for the future of humanity.
You know, the subtitle of your book, Bill, talks about how this war machine, and you're gonna have to change the title, right? So I guess when the next edition, you'll change the title to $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion.
Oh no! We've solved that. We're gonna do a sticker series. So you can get, you can go from 0 to 3 trillion and put it on the front. And we're going to charge more for the stickers than the book, because, I mean, who reads, right? and then we're going to fund the peace movement from the sticker sales.
Well, that's, you know, kind of where I want to get at right now. And then we're going to get into some of the really dark, nefarious aspects of this, because we're going to bring in Silicon Valley and the tech bros, or the techno kings, as they like to call themselves, and how they are involved in all this now. But just this part right now, with regards to how this bankrupts us, obviously, you know, we're spending these trillions and trillions of dollars. That adds into the debt. People understand that, gives a scarcity mindset. We don't have money for A, B, and C. You know, one of the things when I was looking at this is that, you know, it'd be one thing if we were spending all this money, again, this massive increase in military spending, and it was alongside a massive increase in spending for roads and bridges and for schools and for healthcare and for, you know, so can you get into kind of more of the philosophical aspects of this, about how this bankrupting of the United States really doesn't just undermine our future, but it weakens us in the present?
Yeah, well, I think if we go back to Eisenhower, of course, he warned about unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. But he also said defense it requires a healthy population, a well-educated population, a sense of national unity, some sense of restraint that every new invention is not going to save us, and a functioning democracy where the arms establishment doesn't run the show. All those things are being undermined by this current administration and prior ones. So they've really narrowed down to the military tool. And for those of us who have been paying attention, the U.S. has not, quote unquote, won a war in this century, or really in, maybe since World War II. And yet they can stand up with a straight face in Congress and say, we need a generational increase in Pentagon spending for peace through strength, to which I say, well, what peace? What strength? You know, the United States lost wars to people that were blowing up bombs from their telephones when we had satellites, precision-guided munitions, the world's largest air force, because we thought technology would prevail, but it never has. Not in Vietnam, not Reagan's perfect Star Wars, not in Afghanistan or Iraq. And yet that's what the tech folks are selling us. That this new level of technology will put us in the driver's seat globally. China will capitulate because they're like, oh my God, you can make AI. We don't know what that is. You know, so it's all kind of downhill. But as was said in the Muskism piece that you hosted, they're trying to build a different system altogether. You know, so they don't care about traditional government. They want to subvert it. And there's a book coming out from Jill Lepore, who's the historian, more middle of the road in some ways, liberal, but, you know, she's wrote a book on the Constitution. It's called The Artificial State. And basically she says, you know, if the tech folks have their way, there'd be two states. There'd be one that's run by robots that tell us what to do, that they profit from. There'll be another one for them where they do whatever the hell they want and they destroy the environment because they're going to live in space anyway or upload themselves, whatever it is. So it was quite sharp, I thought, because I didn't know if she would go that deep. And I've mostly talked about the military risk, but it's really it's a larger societal risk and a risk to our humanity, as I thought the Muskism episode made quite clear. So it's sort of like they're on autopilot throwing money at this one tool that's failed and then selling us yet another bill of goods about technology saving us. And it's like the Gilded Age on steroids. I mean, the amount of money these people are sucking up from the IPO for SpaceX, you know, Don Jr.'s on the board of a drone company, UAE's putting money in his crypto fund, Saudi invested in Jared's fund, Trump, I mean, you know, every possible product. I mean, I can't even keep track. The bobbleheads, the coins, the stakes, the universities, he's got a piece of United, the unlimited fighting. So that little tussle on the White House lawn, if stock goes up, Trump will profit from that. So it's like every possible way of corruption. And I think back to my dad, who was a Goldwater Republican and a big Nixon fan. And he had a couple sayings. One was, Bill, if you're so smart, how come you're not rich? And I said, well, I don't believe in private property, Dad. And then I turned 70. I'm like, oh, damn it. I should have gotten a little bit rich, you know. And then, but also he said, you know, Nixon should have, you know, like destroyed the tapes. And he was rooting for Nixon. And I think a lot of people root for Trump. Like, I wish I could get away with what he's getting away with. And he said that in some of the debates, like he was, you know, eviscerating the tax code. He says, well, yeah, I know how to do it. You know, I'm allowed to do that. Or like when he had this ethics thing where he brought out all these empty pieces of paper, which were probably like, you know, in The Shining, when Jack Nicholson, you look at what he's writing, he's just writing red rum, red rum, red rum. Well, all those ethics things that Trump was standing by probably said something like that because there was no information there. But he said, ends up as the president, I can do anything I want. And he is. So I think Trump is a symptom of what came before. You know, I would say mainstream Democrats made Trump possible by not meeting people's needs, by caring more about Wall Street than the working class. And then Trump sold them a bill of goods about how he was their friend, you know, the people's billionaire and all that nonsense. So we have a lot to deal with. But this focus, hyper-focus on the military, and not just any military, Hexas military, which is basically like the Michigan militia with better guns. You know, we don't want people of color. We don't want LGBT folks. We don't want anybody who's going to question the whole Trumpian worldview. Or for that matter, we don't want them to be loyal to the Constitution. We want them to be loyal to Donald Trump. So when you put the ideology of MAGA and the tech folks with this technology and people's love of technology, I mean, there's people who still worship Elon Musk because he, you know, found a guy could help put satellites up. We're at a turning point in the country. And I think a lot of folks are going to have to be a little less polite, you know, a little less kind of measured think tanky reformist talk, a little more like, this is a global emergency. We better get our act together.
Right. And I don't want to get to this. I want to ask you whether or not the technology works, but I want to get to the point you just made right there about the use of automation, robots, AI. You see, I don't know if you saw the newest Department of War recruitment advertisement, but it's essentially a bunch of soldiers with rifles, aircraft, tanks firing, with voiceovers from Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth, a celebration of that cult of personality, essentially an advertisement for a MAGA military. And so you're thinking, you know, gosh, the military, it's almost half women and people of color. You know, if you got rid of all the minorities and all the women, you'd have half the military you had. But does this technology intersect then with that ideology, with the desire for a white Christian, patriarchal, nationalistic military that can do more because it's pure and it's sustained or supplemented by this technology?
Yeah, it's sort of like the bar scene in Star Wars or something. I mean, it's like it's 19th century ideology with 21st century technology. So they want to put forward these brave folks with the guns, happen to be white. I don't know how that happened. Happen to be things that Donald Trump or Pete Hegseth themselves would never take the risk to do. But of course, at the same time, they're trying to have not just drones, but pilotless armored personnel carriers and transport vehicles and ships. And there's a thing coming out from Brookings, a guy who's been in the Pentagon, Mark Hansian. He said 12% of the military age folks in America could serve even if they wanted to, because they have a conviction, they're not in good enough shape. And so if you automate, you deal with that problem to some degree. You don't have to be in the same shape to hunt, you know, carry a bunch of equipment across Afghanistan as you do to sit in Nevada running a control board for drones. And when, you know, after 9/11, the Army did a study of today's youth, such as they are. And everybody was saying, oh, these kids, they don't get any exercise. They're in the rooms all the time. They're slackers. They're gamers. Pentagon said, exactly. This is great. They're multitaskers. And that's just what we need for the military of the future. And the Army actually has an esports team that competes in gaming with civilians. And it's one of their biggest recruiting tools, because it's like the one ad is like, all right, all these tough white guys with the voice of God and Hegseth in the background. And the other is like, oh, it's just gaming, man. It's fun. And that's the other sales pitch they're making. So they want that sense of like the rugged individual American, but then they also want automation and control. And if you actually had a rugged individual American with half a brain, they wouldn't listen to these people, right? So they can't really go too far in that direction. But it's really, I mean, it's just everything that's been wrong about our society has been heightened to the point where, well, you know, Marx said history happens first as tragedy and then as farce. There's truth to that, but this farce is so tragic because there's so many people dying that you really can't laugh. You just have to cry for our future if we don't stand up to these folks, you know.
Right. I can't remember if it was Socrates or Plato who said the comic and the tragic are as related as light and shadow. You can't separate the two.
This is my career path. Yes, exactly. I almost majored in the classics, but I couldn't read the Greek alphabet. So
I took two semesters of Greek in college, and now I'm here talking with you. So I
could, that went. I went to Columbia because I thought it was going to be radical, but it was 1973, as quiet as could be. But they had this core curriculum. You got to read Aristotle this week and Dostoevsky next week. Only after 2 years when I realized I didn't have to do all the reading did I get to do any politics. But that stuff sort of stuck. My daughter still thinks I read too many dead white men.
Yeah, I mean, but Are they wrong, though, about the technology? I mean, we're seeing where this is going. We saw the massive use by the Israelis in their genocide in Gaza of artificial intelligence and robots and drones. I mean, essentially, you had artificial intelligence programs, Lavender, Gospel, Where's Daddy, that running on these systems, supposedly with a human in a loop, that had an internet connection to drones. And so if you pulled that human out of the loop, these AI systems could fly those drones and kill those people. We had a story a week or two ago. The Ukrainians said, hey, we used an autonomous drone or drones 2 years ago. Now, they say they only used it one time. I don't believe that. I don't think anyone believes them. But, you know, and as far as I know, Bill, the first time an autonomous drone was actually used was in 2020 in Libya when a Turkish drone flew off and hunted and killed somebody all on its own. So, I mean, are they right? You know, will the technology work?
Well, work towards what end? They've accelerated their ability to kill innocent people. You know, when they talk about targeting and precision, they often make this case, well, it will reduce collateral damage, which is what they said when Saudi Arabia was slaughtering people in Yemen. But they marked all the hospitals. They told them where they were. They bombed them anyway. They bombed funerals, they bombed a school bus, because they didn't care about civilians. And there was this sham program to train them so they wouldn't hit places they didn't mean to hit. They meant to hit the civilians. It was collective punishment. It was the Israeli model. So yes, I think they can accelerate their ability to kill people. You know, that Muskism episode, all the different ways they're trying to control information, how we perceive the world, our media, it works for all of those things. But it does not work for controlling the world, or certainly not for building a better world. So back as far as Vietnam, they had the electronic battlefield. They said, we're going to find every Viet Cong fighter in the jungle, take them out. So they would put urine in pots and leave it there. They thought it was a soldier. Or they'd send an empty convoy and they'd follow that. Within 2 years, they junked the whole thing, even though Westmoreland said it was a revolutionary warfare. Then Reagan had your perfect missile defense, which every physicist who's not on the payroll of the Pentagon says will never work. And that is correct. And now Trump is doing a new version with Golden Dome, which he called Iron Dome after the Israeli one, until they said, oh, no, that's only for short range missiles. So he called it Golden Dome because he likes gold. You know, I mean, it's going to have gold leaf on it or something. And it's going to cost a gazillion dollars. You know, so, yeah, it's just, you know, that's really what the tech bros are selling. I had the honor of being attacked by Palmer Luckey, everybody's favorite gamer who makes autonomous weapons, on X. He read one of my Tom Dispatch pieces. Like, this guy has time on his hands, apparently. And I called him unhinged, which is accurate. And I also said that they want to obliterate any independent testing of the weapons they're trying to sell us. He said, that's not true. I've always been in favor of testing. And he's some sort of a shill. Hartung is a shill. And I'm like, who am I shilling for? The peace movement? What are you talking about? Of course, the peace movement would be a threat to him. So we had an unfruitful round of Xboxing on X, where he basically just kept insulting me. And finally, I said, you know, you don't seem to want to talk about substance. What I was going to say is, you know, I didn't say, you, by your own standards, you're quite successful. You're a 32-year-old billionaire. You're at the cutting edge of technology. You're worshipped by people for what you're doing. And you're the most bitter, cynical, insecure person I've ever seen in my life. What is wrong with you, young man? You know, because I'm 71 and he's 32. But I didn't do that. I didn't want to get into psychotherapy, although I would charge him a good rate.
But didn't Lockheed Martin have someone assigned to you that you had gotten Lockheed Martin, and or maybe it was Boeing, or it was one of the big five, weapons companies that were so upset with you that they have somebody full time monitoring you at one point?
Well, not quite that. They were actually very smart. When my Lockheed Martin book came out, they said, don't criticize it publicly because it'll elevate it in the public eye. But any number of times when I would go to publish things, like the Orlando Sentinel said, well, we ran your piece by the VP here at Lockheed Martin, and he said such and such. I said, do you always run pieces by them? He said, oh, yeah. Big local employer. Washington Post said the same thing. The Post, though, the editor was a guy, Jefferson Morley, who came up through The Nation and various things. And he said, all right, Lockheed Martin says this. So let's put that in your piece and then you refute it. So that's what I did. And then Lockheed Martin took out a full page ad in the same edition of what used to be the separate post op-ed section about how great they were. And we called it a day. But one of their guys did trash me indirectly. Andrew Feinstein, a good friend of mine, South African exile, wrote a book called The Shadow World. He was reviewing Andrew's book, which is about kind of sleazy arms dealers. And the big companies like to say, oh, they're the problem, not us, you know, even though they're interlinked. And so, but Andrew did a big thing at the end of his book about the military industrial complex in the States, quoting from my book. So the Lockheed Martin guy's like, well, he's on firm ground when he talks about these grifters, you know, arms dealers. But then he went astray when he started reading Bill Hartung's criticisms of Lockheed Martin. But they slapped him on the wrist and said, no, we don't want to elevate Hartung's name. Stop doing that. So in a sense, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, why haven't they gone after you, Bill? Well, because I haven't cost them any money yet, you know? So,
but obviously that threat's there, though. I mean, this is, I think, a point we always come back to, that the biggest danger to whether it's the government, to these corporations, to the powers to be, is information. I mean, if Lockheed Martin wasn't going to run that ad in the Washington Post, which costs, what, tens of thousands of dollars, maybe $100,000, unless what you were saying was true and dangerous to them.
Well, also, once you're identified as being a critic, people who don't feel they can say things themselves will tell you stuff. People at Lockheed Martin, people in the tech sector, you know, they'll feed you stuff. There's a woman who was blacklisted from one of the VC firms for saying they shouldn't be funding military work. But one of her investments hit. So she's running a small, quiet little think tank about what the VC firms are up to. But she doesn't want to use her own name because she's had death threats and she's been blacklisted. So she's feeding it to the ecosystem of progressive journalists. And there's a lot of that going on. So it's kind of a privilege. Like I know a lot of young researchers from the ceasefire movement on Palestine who come to me for research ideas. They are way better researchers than I am. I mean, they figured out that they're sending spare parts to Israel by FedEx from the San Francisco airport and that there's a warehouse in Jersey where they did an action to try to stop an Israeli shipping company. So all I can do is to say, it's like when I used to coach my daughter's soccer team, they called me the encourager in chief. You know, like, keep doing what you're doing. And by the way, we're going to be in this for a while. You know, hang in there. Don't give up at the first the first time we get turned back. Because, you know, divestment is at one remove from the problem of supporting genocide, because there's the research itself. You know, and one of the guys who's kind of behind the scenes found out that Israel and Elbit Systems are funding drone research at the University of Central Florida. And one of our researchers wrote it up as an article for The Nation. They also funded a PhD researcher who came up with the system with swarms of drones so they don't collide with each other. And this was one PhD, $500,000. An Israeli company got the patent and allegedly used it for the first successful, quote unquote, use of a swarm of drones. So for what, by, you know, these trillions of dollars we're talking about, this $500,000 created a capability that didn't exist before that allowed Israel to slaughter more people more quickly. So it's that level of detail is what these young researchers are getting to now. The campus stuff has been a little less vocal because they're suspending people, they're going after their scholarships, they're doxing them. But the movement persists, and they're actually integrating with older folks like myself, which I am honored to feel. You know, it's not supposed to be like us telling them what to do. It's like them explaining to us what they know and us working together, and it's happening. You know,
yeah, you know, and they wrap up so much of the technology and this idea of these promises, right? Promises of a better future, and on the military side, of a cleaner version of warfare, more efficient, it'll cost less. And we know that's, you know, not true at all. It's the opposite. And, you know, watching this war with Iran, one of the things I kept coming to was this idea that we're watching the United States fight a 20th century war versus a 21st century opponent. So, yeah. Right. I mean, you had the Iranians destroying $1 billion American radar systems on the first couple days of the war. with drones that cost maybe $15,000, $20,000 using, you know, their own satellites or one single Chinese satellite.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, our aircraft carriers, which cost $13 billion, couldn't get within 1,000 kilometers of the Iranian coast. So, Bill, I think what I want to ask you about is like how much of this new technology is just all the same stuff. It's all the same thinking, at least the same philosophy, the same motives, right? That have always been there.
The fatal flaw of the U.S. system is the companies want to keep making what they're making complicated, hard to use, super costly. And that stuff doesn't work in the wars they find themselves in. And when Congress tries to get rid of stuff like the literal combat ship or the little crappy ship, as people call it, they said no. You know, the not even the production sites, but the places where ships are repaired in Florida and Virginia, the members said, oh, no, you can't retire that. Or they want to retire certain aircraft. No, you can't do that. So they have to carry all this stuff on their books, stuff that even the Pentagon doesn't want. And then if they want new stuff, they got to spend on top of that, which is how we get to a trillion and up. But there's only so many people to maintain it, to build it. So it's the system doesn't work. Like in Ukraine, they were trying to brag about how U.S. technology was winning the war. Well, it ends up they didn't like the Silicon Valley drones. They were brittle. They were expensive. They bought commercial drones from China, threw a bomb and a camera on them. And they've done at least 1 million of those in their little DIY program. But Silicon Valley is still going to claim credit. And in fact, they're like, oh, let us get back in the game. We'll help you. If they help them, the stuff will be like our stuff. It'll be too expensive. It won't work. It'll be in for maintenance. So if the Ukrainians give in to that, then this innovation that they've had, really, it's sort of like, you know, in World War II, they had victory gardens. So, you know, this was like a real thing. This was like what supplanted when, Trump pulled back on aiding them was this DIY drone program. And it doesn't fit the model of what the military industrial complex needs. They need complicated, expensive, never ending. And every time you change, there's a risk that you're going to lose a contract. So, you know, the tech firms want to, on the one hand, say they're going to displace the old guard. On the other hand, they're partnering with them on stuff like Golden Dome. And if we build a $1.5 trillion Pentagon budget, all the thieves will get paid. If we actually lowered it, they might have at each other, use some of that lobbying energy against each other instead of against us. But we're not there yet. But it's just, I think, you know, Ben Freeman, my co-author, really nailed it. Because his head doesn't explode as often as mine does. He actually thinks he thinks about things. And he said, this system really doesn't work for anybody. Even a hardcore militarist, this is not the military you would build if you wanted to win wars. This is a military you would build if you want to enrich companies and have places for generals and admirals to go work when they leave the Pentagon. Or even, you know, now some of them are betting on the poly markets about when we're going to bomb next. Well, guess what? They know that. So it's like instant enrichment. It's not like you work 40 years, you go work for Lockheed. It's like, you know, you're sitting in your cubicle like, oh, I hear a bomb in Iran on Sunday. Let me cash in. I mean, it is obscene and it is relentless. And I think that's why we've had some difficulty getting our footing in the peace and justice movements, because it's everything's so speeded up. And I think we are getting our footing. And I think, you know, in the Muskism episode that you hosted, they pointed out that the big flaw is they haven't really made a social contract with the people who are doing the work. We're going to build the stuff, whose communities are going to be displaced, where the data centers are going to be. They haven't bought them off. They're basically either wanting you to believe this fantasy that you're going to, you know, have free, support from them, or they just don't care. They don't really care about human beings as a writ large. So that's the fatal flaw. And you can see it in the fights against the data centers, against Andrew putting a plant in Ohio, against Musk expanding his space launch facility in Texas, where there's a local lawsuit. That's what's going to bring the whole thing down. That and the fact that if you had a choice of like being controlled by robots or living with actual living, breathing, interesting people, you would probably choose people. You know, I'm just saying. But to get there, we have to fight through all this power and money. But we've done it before. It's sort of like 3D chess. I can't even play chess. I mean, I know how to move the pieces. I know how to lose. But this is at a different level. But luckily, I'm not alone. There's people who do know this, most of them many years younger than me. And we're all coming together, and the quicker the better, you know.
You know, I did have time doing acquisition and testing. And in 2008, I was with the Joint IED Defeat Organization. So we were the Department of Defense organization responsible for finding technologies to protect American soldiers from improvised explosive devices, to find those devices, to defeat them, et cetera. And I led a team. We were supposed to find technologies that could see suicide bombers, that you could see 100 yards away that a guy was wearing a suicide vest. And so we assembled all these companies. We had them bring in all their various cameras and X-ray systems and thermal detectors, and we ran tests. And what we found after testing more than 30 different devices, that only two systems actually worked. One of those was the big $400,000 scanners that you go through at the airport. You know, the ones that, right? And those, you can't put those outside. They won't work outside, especially not going to work outside, you know, in Anbar province in Iraq in July. Yeah, but the other thing that worked, and it was the $3,000 metal detectors that you have at your county courthouse. And so we briefed this to our leadership. And I remember our deputy director said to me, "You don't understand. No matter how well it works, no matter how feasible it is, no matter how much this would actually protect American soldiers, we are never going to buy something that only costs $3,000.
Exactly. Right?
And I mean, and that's the way the system works. I mean, that's the way the system's set up. You have a military industrial complex that's not built, right? That's not meant to provide for the national security interests of the United States of America. It's meant to provide profits to corporations. But the thing I want to get back to, what you just talked about there, was the human aspect in all of this. And you know, we have, of course, I think the people watching are saying, "Hey, you're talking about AI and warfare, and you haven't brought up Manav yet, right?" Whereas we can understand it was AI that helped the United States target and bomb, what, three times that girls' school in Manav, Iran, to open up this war, killed more than 160 school children. And the artificial intelligence had a major role in that. But I want to talk more about what the effect is on people, right? And this idea that war is ultimately a test of wills. And what you saw with an act like that, besides the horror of it, the crime of it, the galvanizing effect it had on the Iranian population. I remember watching a video of a young Iranian girl being interviewed because as her father fired his hunting rifle at American helicopters, she refused to go inside because she wanted to fight the child killers as well. And I mean, so this technology, regardless of how much money it works, how much money it makes for the corporations, or regardless of whether it actually works or not, is it in the end defeating because it takes out the human element?
Yes. You know, they used to say, well, you know, the drone operators are at a remove, but a lot of them are getting PTSD because they have to watch the person die. They have to watch them bleed out. Sometimes they even do the double tap strike against the people coming to aid them. A fighter pilot doesn't see any of that. So the idea that you can remove yourself is kind of misguided. Or when Pete Hegseth says, won't tell him how much the war is going to cost, is, well, it costs a lot of money to kill bad guys. Immediately, I thought of those schoolgirls. I thought of the nurses bringing kids in incubators out of hospitals that were being bombed. And I was like, what the hell are you talking about? And this information can be put together relatively easily, even when the media is trying to cloud it. And of course, there's many places to get good information if people know where to go and they don't get the rabbit holes and conspiracy theories, so forth. So, or in Gaza, you know, just all the film that people put up of the genocide. So as much as they want to control what we think, what we say, what we do, they don't really... I don't think they understand how human beings work, you know? Like, I think they can run over people, bully them, and they're going to comply. Well, that's not how it works. They're not going to fight back with drones and atomic weapons, but they're going to fight back. And they're not going to forget if you've killed their leaders, their family, their friends. They're going to find a way to respond. And this administration acts as if, as does Netanyahu, you can just destroy and intimidate, and that's the last move. That's just the beginning of the next generation of warfare. And that, if we don't get people to understand that, we're not going to get out of this mess. But I think people are coming to understand, especially younger generations, and also certainly the generations who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan. A lot more opposition, open opposition, but also a lot of people who feel like they don't know why they sent them there. They didn't think they could win. They knew the government lied to them. Folks who are not talking vocally about it, but who feel that way. So that they're having a hard time recruiting because they recruit for military families, and people have been in those wars like, yeah, you don't want to do that. So this kind of techno, robotic warfare thing kind of almost is their magic solution to the fact that people aren't going to want to fight in these wars anymore.
Right. And then, you've brought up Lockheed. Certainly there's Raytheon and Boeing and Northrop. But we have this new generation of companies that, again, are looking Silicon Valley based tech bros, techno kings, looking to get their pound of flesh, if you will, from this cash cow. You brought up Palmer Luckey, who runs Anduril, the drone company. And there's certainly Alex Karp with Palantir, Elon Musk at SpaceX. How dangerous is this idea that these companies may be replacing the defense giants that whose CEOs we didn't know? So all the other things that we've spoken about here, how dangerous is that we may have a Pentagon that's spending trillions of dollars a year with a huge percentage of that going to these companies owned by these techno kings? I mean, what kind of dystopian right hellscape could that bring about? Not to lead you with the question, but
Well, I should correct myself. Although there are women in the tech circles, some of their chief ideologists, but they act like bros, so they're like honorary bros. But people like Catherine Boyle from Andreessen Horowitz. But the thing is, the head of Lockheed Martin, if there's a war, he'll on the investor call say, "Well, this turbulence in the Middle East could increase demand for our products among our allies, who will try to bring stability to the region." So they try to cover it in this kind of antiseptic bubble. Palmer Luckey goes on TV and says, "Oh yeah, we can bury China, man. Just use my technology." And it's like, hello, you know they're a nuclear-armed country, right? You really think it's about how much ammunition we have left after we start exchanging, nuclear strikes? But what does he know? He's a gamer who makes weapons, who wants to also run our foreign policy. And I say, hell no. If you have a product that works, you're a vendor. We'll think about it. We'll test it. We'll look at it. But you are not going to run our foreign policy. You're not going to run our economy. You're not going to remake our government. But that's exactly what they're trying to do. So I would say their ideology is as dangerous as their technology. And that's really the challenge. The other thing, though, is I think if you take a close, hard look at them, they're uniquely unattractive human beings that you don't really want to hitch your wagon to. And so that, in a perverse way, works in our favor in that they're not hiding anything. Like, I don't even know if I have to research corruption anymore because they're bragging about it,
Right.
It's like all out there. I might as well just do comedy full time.
Again, now we're back to this intersection of tragedy and comedy. But Bill, that's unfortunately all the time we have here today. Bill Hartung is a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He is, along with Ben Freeman, the author of The $1 trillion War Machine. I want to say something about this book. I'm in the same spaces as Bill. We're colleagues at the Eisenhower Media Network. I've been doing this for since 2009, think tank space, media space, things like this. And I got to tell you, it's been a while since I have had so many people ask me, have you read Bill and Ben's book? This is really great. So Bill, just something to you, but for the folks watching, among the experts, this is the book that I've heard talked about most in a long time. So Bill, thank you for what you do. Thank you for being on the show, for your insights. I'm sorry, you're going to say?
Yeah, well, just a little secret. Ben wrote the whole book and let me put my name on it.
I doubt that very much. But anyway, for all those watching, please like, share, and comment on this episode of Deep Focus, where we bring you deep discussions on the topics of the day. Thank you for watching.
Yeah, thanks. It was great.